Good morning, Graham Church. You look like summer. Oh, it is good to see you. Esther chapter 3, you'll find the book of Esther, two books before the Psalms in the Old Testament. You're using a seatback Bible. You can find it at page 411. Esther 3 is where we're going to pick up the story of Esther and Mordecai and Haman and the great secret of the book, the work of God in the nation of Israel. Pride. The dictionary defines pride this way: a feeling or deep pleasure or satisfaction derived from one's own achievements, the achievements of those with whom one is closely associated, or from qualities or possessions that are widely admired. You look at pride in the Bible, you'll come up with a different perspective. Scripture defines pride as the root of all sin, the opposite of humility. Pride is a misplaced sense of worth. Psalm 10, verse 4, God says, "I hate pride and arrogance." James 4, 6, God opposes the proud. If you want to see pride in action, I don't think you'll find a better example anywhere than this fellow Haman, whom we are going to look at this morning. Haman's pride causes him to try to take down God's covenant people, the Jews. For a couple of weeks now, we've been looking at the story of Esther. And Esther is a Jewish young woman who marries the most powerful king in all the earth, and she becomes the queen of Persia. All of this takes place near the end of the timeline of the Old Testament, several centuries before Jesus Christ. Esther's life starts out as a complete mess, but then a crisis arrives and she is providentially used by God to save her people. She becomes the heroine of the story. But this morning, instead of looking at Esther herself, we're going to be looking at the villain of the story, the antagonist, and his name is Haman. Haman is determined to kill every Jew in the empire, not just those in Susa or near the capital or in the boundaries of Persia itself, but all the Jews in all the empire, including the Jews in Palestine. Haman is just about the clearest case study of pride in all the scriptures. You want to see what pride is and what pride does to a person when it rages unchecked, you can't find a better example than this guy. There's a lot we can learn from Haman: what pride looks like, what pride does to you, and then how pride is cured. First of all, what pride looks like. Chapter 3 of Esther, first verse. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. Haman has now the highest position in the kingdom. He's essentially prime minister. He has the same role in Persia that Joseph finally got in Egypt, running everything. He's got power. He's got wealth. What else could a guy want? Verse 2 gives us a clue. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. So what you ought to note first is that the king has to command people to bow down to Haman. I think that this is an indication that something is amiss. Haman was particularly unpopular. He must have been, well, obnoxious. Certainly he was unliked, because traditional societies like Persia, well, bowing is just instinctive. You don't have to be commanded. You know that if somebody who is in authority, somebody who is in high power comes by you, you bow. But the king has to give a command that for Haman in particular, people must bow. But one fellow would not bow, and that was Mordecai. Mordecai is Esther's cousin or uncle, and has become Esther's guardian before she got married. And Mordecai refuses to give respect to Haman because he isn't respectable. He's not going to do it. Chapter 3, verse 3. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, he would not listen to them. They told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. So, why is it that Haman is so furious that one person won't bow down? Well, I suspect it's because Mordecai is a humiliating reminder of what Haman already knew in his heart. That in spite of all of his wealth, in spite of all of his power, in spite of the fact that the vast majority of the people are forced to kneel to him, Haman does not have the respect of people. They weren't truly honoring him. They were doing what they had to do, everybody except for Mordecai, of course. Chapter 5, verse 11. And Haman recounted, he's at home, he's talking to his friends, he's talking to his wife. Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Verse 13. Yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. He is furious. All this honor, all this wealth, all this power, and all he just consumed with one person, and that's Mordecai. So, come back full circle now. What is pride? What can we learn? What is it that Haman is struggling with? Pride, according to the Bible, is self-absorption. You want to know what pride is? That's what it is. It's self-absorption. It's a concentration on self. C.S. Lewis calls pride the great sin, the essential vice. Pride is the center of Christian morals. He said, pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind. It makes you concentrate on everything about you. Whether you're in a relationship or doing a job, you don't do anything unless it makes you feel good about yourself. Everything is about you. That's what pride looks like. For example, Lewis said, pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more than the next man. So you might feel perfectly satisfied in having an education, you got a degree, or having certain achievements, or political success, but that's not enough. You might have money, you might have family, but when you're surrounded by folks who have more or better, you lose all pleasure in it. Really nice car, but you're surrounded by people who have nicer cars. You got a really decent looking wife. You're surrounded by people who've got drop dead gorgeous wives, better looking than your own. And you lose pleasure in it. Because pride is all about comparison. Now look at Haman. Haman gets no satisfaction from his accomplishments. Look what he's done. He's done what nobody else in the kingdom has done. He has written to the very top of power. Everybody is beneath him except for the king himself. He's got wealth, he's got achievement, he's got political success, but Haman wants respect. He wants honor. He wants people to approve of him. And the reason is because ultimately pride is idolatry. Ian Duguid is absolutely right when he says, Haman is a case study in what happens in our hearts when our heart idols are challenged. he had made public recognition his idol. And the result was that as long as he was receiving adulation, he felt great. So when Haman loses that honor, when he loses that adulation, even from one person, he lashes out in anger because that one person is stealing his idol. That one person is dashing his dreams. It's obsessive. Even though he has unparalleled power in the kingdom, it wasn't enough. Because there's this void at the center of his being that no amount of success can fill. He loves the praise of men. That's what Haman lives for. For respect, for honor, for the delight of praise of people. There's this occasion where the Apostle Paul is defending himself from attacks. And in Galatia in particular, the false teachers are attacking Paul. And they're saying, Paul, you are a proud man. What's he say? Galatians 1:10. For am I now seeking the approval of man? Or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I was still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ. So when you make the approval of others your idol, you're not serving God, says the Apostle Christ, Apostle Paul. So pride is a concentration on self, absorption in self, and you know, Haman is struggling with this thing, and he gets no help on the home front. No one points out to him what's driving his life. Someone should have somebody, you know, Mrs. Haman should have loved him enough that she should have said, wait a minute, hubby, you're obsessing on this thing. This rage, it should be showing you that there's something wrong in your heart. You've got a heart condition. You've got this God-sized hole in your heart. And you should be joyful, Haman. Look at everything you've got. Look at everything that God has given you. And you're furious instead. So he gets no help at home because Haman comes and he talks to his wife, he talks to his friend, and they just feed his idolatry. Chapter 5, verse 14. He tells them what's going on. He tells them about Mordecai. Chapter 5, verse 14. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. Now, that word is translated gallows in the English Standard Version. The word is literally tree. It's a 75-foot tall pole. It's a stake. And the Persian practice typically was not to hang somebody by the neck. You think of gallows and you think of, you know, like in the Old West, you know, they take a murderer and they'd hang him from the neck. That's probably not the practice. Probably what they did on this pole was to impale somebody. They'd take them and they'd stick them on the top and they'd leave their body up there for the birds to eat. And it was a display. And so Haman's wife and his friends are trying to quench Haman's anger by going for a giant-sized vengeance. You want to have joy, Haman? You want to finally be satisfied in your life? Then put this guy on the top of a pole. Kill him. But vengeance never works. Vengeance never works because it doesn't deal with the underlying problems. Tim Keller says that there are a couple of forms of pride that are crucial that we recognize. And I think he's absolutely right. And that's why I want to bring these out, because we tend to think of, well, there's two kinds of pride. And we tend to think of the first one. The first one is, I admire myself. And this is a superiority form of pride. We get this. I mean, I think most of us, you know, when I say pride, you understand this. Am I going to be recognized? How do others think about me? And I'm first, and I'm better than everybody else. We get that. But the other form of pride is, I denigrate myself. This one's a little harder to detect. And a lot of people struggle with this. It's the inferiority form of pride. That is where you're always down on yourself. You don't like how you look. You don't like how you're doing. You're always beating yourself up. And the problem with this is you're just as self-absorbed as the person who admires themselves, the superiority form of pride. You're totally self-absorbed, but you're self-absorbed with self-condemnation. You're doing the comparison thing, and you never measure up. And that's pride, too. Woe is me. You know, I'll never be as good as that. I'll never make first squad. I'll never be first chair in the orchestra. I'll never get the promotion, and I'll never get a girlfriend. And you're always beating up on yourself, and that's pride. And it's deadly. So here's what we usually miss. These two proud people, the superiority form of pride and the inferiority form of pride, have a lot more in common than the completely humble person. Humility, true humility, is not beating up on yourself. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity says, if you want to find somebody who's humble, quote, he will not be thinking about humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all. That's humility. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. Humility is thinking of yourself less. Humility is not being needy for approval or respect. It's not caring about approval or respect. I'm not here for the praise and opinion of men. I don't do things. I don't hang out with people. I don't serve people here because I want approval. I do it because I love God and I want to serve God and I want to please Him. So it seems to me that when you hang out with truly humble people, you don't get the impression that they're humble. When you hang out with truly humble people, you come away thinking that they're really happy and they actually care about and they're interested in you. It's not about themselves. Haman, on the other hand, Haman is totally self-absorbed. His idol is the approval of men. So that's what pride looks like. Pride looks like self-absorption and idolatry. What does pride do to you? Go back to chapter 3. Here's what pride does to you. Chapter 3, verse 5. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Now this is really telling. Haman is not going to be satisfied with knocking off Mordecai. He's going to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews. All of them. He wants to commit genocide. He would murder all the community and all the empire. So Haman goes to King Xerxes, Ahasuerus, and he makes up this story about a group of people who won't obey the king's laws. Haman introduces a financial motive. He says to the king, it's not to the king's profit to tolerate them. They're costing you money. They're not contributing enough to you, king. And the King Ahasuerus has run up a huge war debt at this time. He had a disastrous military campaign against the Greeks. And about this time, Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, he's got two names, Ahasuerus and Xerxes. King Ahasuerus is in deep trouble financially. He needs an influx of cash. So Haman suggests, kill all of them. Take all of their stuff, and lots of that will come into the king's treasury. The sad thing is, Ahasuerus doesn't even bother to find out who these people are. He completely trusts Haman. And so the king says, go ahead. Do what seems good to you. Verse 11, chapter 3. And this law that Ahasuerus has now passed is irrevocable. The law of the Medes and the Persians. It can't be changed. And so Haman drew lots to decide the date for the massacre. It's like throwing dice. Threw the dice, and when the dice came out, they set the date that the massacre would take place several months hence. And the word for lots or dice, lots, is a word pur, P-U-R, pure, or pur. And that's where the Jewish holiday Purim comes from, the casting of lots, from this event that they cast the lot, set the date where the great massacre was going to take place. The Jews were going to be completely wiped out. On that day, when the lot was determined, that day, all the neighbors of all the Jews everywhere were legally permitted to kill all of the Jews and take their wealth as plunder. Everywhere in the Bible, we're told that pride always leads to devastation. Pride always leads to a fall. Pride leads to ruin and destruction and disgrace because pride is deadly. Just think about what pride does to you. Pride makes you stupid. Pride makes you stupid. Well, how's that? Well, pride keeps you from learning from your mistakes. In general, pride keeps you from listening to others. Why? Because a proud person always justifies himself or herself. There's always blame shifting. It's not me. It's him. It's her. It's not my fault. You always recognize a proud person. Well, it's not my fault. Somebody else did it. Somebody else caused it. Somebody else did this to me. When you're always self-justifying, you aren't learning from your mistakes and you're stupid. And we as readers, as the story is flowing along, we're entranced as Haman is being led along like a bull to the slaughter. Esther invites him to this great dinner where she's going to reveal to the king what's really going on in her kingdom. And Haman has caused utter chaos in the kingdom. Chapter 3, verse 15, the last part of the verse, the very end of chapter 3. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. Why? All because of Haman's pride. Haman never bothers to ask himself why Mordecai won't bow down to him. It doesn't matter because proud people never seem to learn from their criticism anyway. One of the best ways to grow as a person is to take criticism and to listen to it and to humbly find out what's true in it. But when you're proud, you hear criticism and you immediately, well, you dismiss it. It isn't true. It isn't relevant. Or if you have the inferiority form of pride, you let criticism completely crush you so that when people talk to you, you just melt down and you never learn anything. So, really, what we're saying is that a proud person is a fool. What's a fool? Biblically, who is a fool? Proverbs 15:5. A fool despises his father's instruction, but whoever heeds reproof is prudent. Proverbs 17:10, a rebuke goes deeper into a man of understanding than 100 blows into a fool. Because a proud person doesn't learn from their mistakes. If you don't learn from your mistakes and you don't listen to and you don't learn from criticism, you're a fool and you're stupid. You'll constantly be making wrong moves, as does Haman. Pride makes you evil. Be bad enough he was just dumb and doing dumb things and bringing harm down on his own head. But pride is the root of all other sins, and pride is what made Satan fall. And in the garden, the serpent appealed to Eve's pride. Pride, it could be said that pride is like a petri dish in which all the other garbage in your life grows. I really don't think that Haman set out to become the Hitler of his day. His overarching pride setting to it. It was his pride that made him bitter. It was his pride that made him angry. It was his pride that made him insecure and afraid of lack of respect. It was his pride that drove him to become the mass murderer of his day. So stop and think about it for a minute. What were the sins that led ultimately to Haman's downfall? Well, conspiracy, lying, possibly greed. But underneath and feeding all of them is his pride. And that's how pride works. Are you struggling to forgive? Well, if you're struggling to forgive, it's likely because you want to hang on to the reins of justice yourself instead of yielding them to God. And that's playing God. That's pride. Is your marriage struggling because you can't sort out who's on first? Well, that's pride. Lust and greed and anger, underneath all of those is pride. Pride is never satisfied, and it will eat your heart out until you will take any steps necessary to feed that idolatry in your soul. It makes you evil. And pride makes you blind. What does pride do to you? It makes you blind. Haman is completely blind to what's happening to him. And that's what pride does. Pride is invisible. It's like carbon monoxide. It comes into the room. You can't smell it. You can't see it. You can't tell it's there. And you don't recognize what it's doing until you're dead. And that's the way pride works. Have you ever noticed that most people who are proud don't even know that they're proud? Because it's odorless. It's colorless. The more proud you are, the less proud you think you are. Think about it for a minute. You know when you're embezzling from the company, don't you? You know when you're lusting after that person who's not your wife. You know it. You know for sure when you're sleeping with somebody else's wife. You know when you're cursing. But pride's invisible. It's been my observation that almost nobody confesses pride. People will confess this sin, sexual sin or lust, or people will confess anger, people will confess unforgiveness, but almost nobody confesses pride because pride makes you blind to the fact that you're proud. I'm not wrong. I'm the victim. I'm righteously angry. I'm incapable of mistakes. I don't have any blind spots. I don't need to be accountable to anybody. I don't need to be in a small group where I have to answer to somebody else because I don't have any blind spots. I really don't. Haman, this whole story is just amazing as you walk chapter after chapter after chapter, because Haman is just one tiny step from complete destruction. And he never sees it at all. He is completely clueless. And that's why this room is probably filled with people who are struggling with pride and don't even know it. Pride makes you blind. And blindness means, because pride makes you blind, that means that pride thrives on religion. Because pride blinds you to what it is and what it's doing to your heart, then it feeds on religion. Like Tim Keller said, religious pride is the worst kind of pride. So how does that fit in here? I mean, God doesn't even appear in the book of Esther. Why is it we're talking about religion in the book of Esther? It's simply because, well, let me put it this way. Some of you have already begun to tune me out this morning because you know exactly where this thing is going. You've already got this figured out. Mike, this is a completely predictable sermon. Thank you. I can see where this thing is going. You're saying pride is bad. Yes, very bad. I got it. What's the solution? I need to get closer to God. I need to pray more. I need to obey the Ten Commandments more. I need to humble myself more before God. This will deal with pride. I gotcha. Take two pills of religion every day, and I got this pride thing whipped. And that's the worst thing about pride. We think that the remedy to pride is to get very religious and start being good and start going to church and start being more spiritual. But the amazing thing is, when you look in the scriptures, the most religious and the most proud people in the Bible are the Pharisees. This thing is deadly because pride and religion coexist in our hearts to deceive. And that kills you. Religion works pretty well when it comes to killing off some sins. But trying to deal with pride by religiosity is like pouring oil on a fire. It doesn't work. It always produces self-righteousness. When you take a proud person and you introduce religion into their heart, all they do is think, I've got this. I've done it. I'm handling this. So that's what pride does to you. It makes you stupid, it makes you evil, and it makes you blind. And when you become blind, then you become religious, and that will kill you. How is pride cured? How do we cure pride? Here in chapter 6, the one thing that Haman wants most, is not to just kill Mordecai. He doesn't just want to massacre the Jews. He wants to make a spectacle out of Mordecai. Got this huge pole. You know how big 75 feet is? This is a massive pole. I don't even know where they got a tree that big in that part of the world. Huge pole, public place, because Mordecai, hanging up there, impaled on the top of that tree in this public place, is going to be a representative for all the Jews on the day when they're all going to be slaughtered. So, King Xerxes has a sleepless night. Chapter 6, verse 1, he can't get to bed, can't get to sleep. On the night when the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. So, what's the one thing you do when you can't get to sleep? You read really boring stuff. And something is nagging at the king's conscience. He sends to the government archives, and he discovers then that Mordecai has saved his life from plotters who are going to assassinate the king. Verse 2, and it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And so the king has to do something for Mordecai. He has to reward him. And the king says, verse 3, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? The king's young men who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. So he's got to reward Mordecai somehow. So what's he do? He calls in his right-hand man. He calls in Haman to suggest a way to honor this fellow who saved his life. But Haman is completely blind. Completely blind. Haman's there, verse 6. Haman comes in, and the king says to him, what should be done to the man to whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? He's blind. Everybody else reading the story knows exactly what's going on, but Haman is completely blind. And what Haman wants more than anything is honor from the most powerful king. What his heart craves is honor from the most powerful king. He's terribly insecure. He wants respect. He wants approval. He wants honor. He wants glory. He doesn't need wealth. He's got it. He doesn't need power. He's got it. He's got plenty. But he wants to be treated just like the king in public. Verse 7. And Haman says to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown set, and let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials, and let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Now, in ancient times, robes had great significance. When Pharaoh put robes on Joseph in Genesis 41, Joseph takes the king's position. It's like a crown in the sense the robe, to wear the king's robe, it's like wearing the king's crown. And when Jonathan gives his kingly robes to David in 1 Samuel 18, Jonathan is saying to David, I love you, and you should be in the king's place instead of me, the king's position. And so when the king gives somebody his robes, he's saying, here, sit on my throne. Sit at my right hand. And here's why Haman is so excited. This is what Haman's heart truly craves, to be loved and honored by someone who will give him the acclaim and respect and honor that he thinks he must have. If the king will do this for me, if the king gives me his robe and the royal stallion, if the king gives the order and I'm paraded through Susa just like royalty when the word is put out, the king is honoring this man. And what Haman craves is for someone more significant to think he's significant, to honor him. And he will do anything to get it. This is Haman's dream day. Everything that he could ever long for, everything he could ever imagine, here it is. And then everything turns completely upside down. Incredible and amazing reverse of fortune. Ian Duguid calls this Haman's terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. Solomon in Proverbs 29, one's pride will bring him low, but he who is lowly in spirit will obtain honor. Verse 10. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. This is the great reversal. Mordecai was about to be killed and shamed and buried in the dust heap of failures. And now Mordecai is put high on the pinnacle of power and success. Haman was about to be honored like no other. And now Haman is the role of a servant. Reality rains down on Haman's parade. His dream has turned into a nightmare. And his own words come back to haunt him. And Haman knows he is doomed as soon as the word comes out of Xerxes' mouth. Haman knows that because he tried to put himself up, and now he's been brought down, and we have this incredible reversal. And this is exactly what the Bible shows from cover to cover about pride. Matthew 23:12. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. This reversal is all through the Bible. This is the principle of the universe. That if you seek to lift yourself up, sooner or later you will be brought down. Why? Because this is the way that God made the world. It's in His nature. It seems to me that when you think about it, Haman's real heart issue might surprise you. Haman does not ask for the wrong thing. He desires something we all desire. He desires significance. He desires glory. We all want somebody with ultimate glory loving us. We all want ultimate assurance that we have worth and significance. We all want meaning and value. But Haman went to the wrong king. There is a better king. There is a king with ultimate glory who, believe it or not, came to earth. He wasn't just... He came to earth and he stripped himself of his glory. He wasn't just stripped of his clothes. When he went to the cross, he was literally stripped of his father's love. He was stripped of his father's approval, of his father's respect. Why? Because he was reversing places with us. Mordecai was saved only because Haman reversed places with him involuntarily. Jesus does it voluntarily. There's the ultimate king. There's the king of glory. Jesus Christ is the king that you can go to because he at infinite cost reversed places with us. 2 Corinthians 5:21. For our sake, he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Haman put up a tree intending to hang his worst enemy on it. Jesus climbed up on the tree and took the place of his enemies so he could save us. He substituted himself for the likes of me. Haman declared that the people must die for the sins of one man. The gospel declares that one man, God himself, died to cover the sins of the people. And you know, the problem is, it's not enough to just say, well, you know, I believe in God. That doesn't make you humble. It might make you religious, but you're still proud. What you have to see is God coming all the way down and reversing places with us at infinite cost to himself. Because on the one hand, to know that he had to die for you humbles you. To know that he was glad to die for you, it affirms you and I infinitely. Jesus was strong enough that he became weak. He was so strong that he didn't care what people said about him, didn't care what people thought. He was so strong that he was able to do the right thing. And if you see him doing that for you, you'll be strong enough to be weak. When you have your eyes on Christ and see what he did for you in the glory of the gospel, and you'll have the strength to say no to self. You'll have the strength to learn from your mistakes, strength to, enough to take jobs and have relationships that don't just make you feel good about yourself, but they're the right things to do. C.S. Lewis, from Mere Christianity. If anyone would like to acquire humility, I can, I think, tell him the first step. The first step is to realize that one is proud. And a biggest step, too. At least, nothing whatever can be done before it. If you think you are not conceited, it means that you are the very conceited indeed. Jesus humbled himself to kill our pride, to take our punishment. And if you will humble yourself before him, he will cure your proud, wicked, conceited, self-centered heart. And then he will exalt you. If you put yourself at the bottom, you make yourself the lowest, he will exalt you to the first place. Will you let him do that for you? Let's stand together. Father, it is true that it should have been me on that tree. It should have been me taking the punishment for my sin. And you covered it all. How can we even begin to understand the glory of all of that? Let it humble us. Let it change us. Transform us by the power of your good news, the power of your grace. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.